myself, yeah, Ankara, Ankara. Kwenye chwaki hii ya Army B. Get money, money, make money, money, money. Welcome kwanza kwanza meza nindo kisha.
You are tuned in to African Perspective, your news show for African news and views from the continent. I'm your host today, Omaysama Rahemthula, and our show today will be focusing on the current electoral crisis in Côte d'Ivoire. So we'll be joined by two guests later on today who will be giving us their perspective and their analysis on what's going on in the Côte d'Ivoire right now. And to start off, as we always do, we'll bring you headlines. So stay tuned. This is African Perspectives on CHRY 105.5 FM.
Heshima nerudi mkumna shine mseme asante hamsomi kama inabidi hamsikila na diswala wala sauti za kanisa hamsini mnaziona nyingi safi mnaseto kabisa hisio kama cinema wisha watu we mazima maisha yana rewind ya kisema loshe muma msipoteze wakati kutofotishe vipi tunachofanya sini mziki sitaji kundi la watu usinite bongo flavor japo kwa bongo ni.
And welcome back. You are of course tuned in to African Perspectives here on CHRY 105.5 FM. And here are your headlines from the African continent. Tunisian President Zine Al Abidine Ben Ali has stepped down after 23 years in power as protests over economic issues snowballed into rallies against him. Prime Minister Mohamed Gan Ouchi has taken over as interim president and a state of emergency has been declared. Mr. Ben Ali left Tunisia with his family and has since arrived in Saudi Arabia. The past weeks have seen popular protests sweep the country over issues of unemployment, food price increases, and corruption. The protests started after an unemployed graduate set himself on fire when police tried to prevent him from selling vegetables without a permit. He died a few weeks later. Demonstrations came to a head on Friday as thousands of people gathered outside the Interior Ministry as a symbol of the regime, and many climbed onto its roof. Police responded with a volley of tear gas grenades. President Ben Ali, who had already promised to step down in 2014, dissolved his government and the country's parliament and declared a state of emergency. Then, in a televised address on Friday afternoon, Prime Minister Gan Ouchi announced that he would be taking over from President Ben Ali. Mr. Gan Ouchi is a former finance minister who had been prime minister since 1999. He has promised to, quote, respect the law and carry out the political, economic, and social reforms that have been announced. And in neighboring Algeria last week saw mass protests by youth over rising costs and unemployment. Youth blockaded major regional roads around Boumerdès, about 60 kilometers east of Algiers, and Benjaï, 200 kilometers further east. Protests have also been reported at Mitre Square, Balkor, Bash Jarha, Babal Wadi, and Astawali, while both Jalfa in southern Algeria and Wahran in west also witnessed rallies in protest over deteriorating living conditions and raising prices. The General Union of Algerian Traders and Artisans said prices had risen between 20 and 30% in recent days, with the cost of sugar and oil up sharply since the start of the month. About 75% of Algerians are under the age of 30, and 20% of the youth are unemployed, according to the International Monetary Fund. Voting has ended in Sudan in the South's historic independence referendum, with a large turnout for the week-long poll. The vote is widely expected to see the South choose overwhelmingly to separate from the North. The referendum was a condition of the 2005 peace deal, which ended a 21-year civil war. Official results of the vote are not expected until early next month. Polling stations closed in Sudan at 6 p.m. local time on Saturday. Turnout was extremely high for the vote, with the referendum commission chairman saying that by Friday, some 83% of the registered voters cast their ballots in the South. Many of those were in the first few days, with giant queues snaking for hundreds of meters around the polling station. About 53% of the eligible voters turned out in the North. A senior official from the Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir's National Congress Party said on Saturday that Khartoum would accept the outcome of the vote, even if it meant partition of Africa's largest nation. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan has won his ruling party primaries, making him a favorite for April's election. Mr. Jonathan's main challenger was ex-Vice President Atiku Abubakar, who was supported by some northern power brokers. The People's Democratic Party candidate has won every poll since the end of military rule in 1999. However, most of its victories have been marred by widespread fraud and violence. As Vice President Jonathan became leader after the death of elected President Umaru Yar Adua last May, nevertheless, he won just over 2,700 votes compared to Mr. Abubakar's 805. A third candidate, Sarah Jibril, gained a single vote. Mr. Jonathan has promised to introduce electoral reform, but correspondents say it will be difficult to implement radical changes before April. The main opposition candidates are former anti-corruption campaigner Nuhu Ribadu and General Muhammadu Buhari. France's highest court has upheld an order to extradite Rwandan rebel leader Calixte Mabura Shimana to face trial at the International Criminal Court. A lawyer from Mabura Shimana said that the court had rejected his client's appeal against extradition. Mabura Shimana is accused of 11 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity, allegedly committed in the Democratic Republic of Congo last year. The ICC in The Hague says there is evidence suggesting that Mr. Mabaru Shimana, who has lived in France as a political refugee since 2002, contributed to the crimes in the DR Congo via local and international media. The international diamond watchdog, the Kimberley Process, has reportedly denied giving Zimbabwe permission to carry on selling diamonds from the controversial Chiadzawa fields. According to the news service for the U.S.-based Repertoire Diamond Trading Network, a Kimberley Process representative has refuted the claims made by Zimbabwean Mines and Mining Development Deputy Minister Gift Chimankire, a spokesperson for the Kimberley Process chairman in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, has said that no decision has been yet reached. Up to 80 African migrants are feared to have drowned off the south coast of Yemen after their boat capsized. The migrants, mostly from Ethiopia, were traveling in two boats which were hit by strong wind and waves. Three Somali migrants were reportedly found alive while the coast guards were searching for any other survivors. Hundreds of Africans drown each year trying to reach Yemen in crowded boats. Thousands of people attempt the dangerous journey from Africa across the Gulf of Aden to Yemen every year. The UN's refugee agency says more than 74,000 Africans arrived in Yemen in 2009. Fleeing desperate situations in the Horn of Africa. Yemen is seen as a gateway to a better life in the Middle East or Europe, but people smugglers often crowd the migrants onto old and unseaworthy vessels. Hundreds of would-be migrants die before reaching their destinations. Makerere University in Uganda is considering altering its government sponsorship admission criteria to ensure that reasonable numbers of both girls and boys are admitted to each course. The new measures are expected to be in place before Makerere's admissions in August. They may impose an admission ratio of 60 to 40 for government sponsorship in humanities and a 70 to 30 ratio for science courses in favor of the less represented sex in each academic discipline. And that brings us to the end of our headlines from the African continent. This week, your headlines are credited to Pambazuka News, Al Jazeera, and the BBC. And you are tuned in to CHRY 105.5 FM. This is African Perspectives. We're going to take a quick music and community listings break, and we'll be back with our first interview that will be looking at the current impasse in the elections in the Côte d'Ivoire. Stay tuned, CHRY 105.5 FM. That's right, you are tuned into CHRY 105.5 FM, and this is African Perspectives. On October 31st, 2010, the people of Côte d'Ivoire voted in the presidential elections that had been postponed for 5 years. The results of this electoral contest show that Laurent Gbagbo, the intellectual turned trade unionist and politician, won the first round with about 35% of votes. Two other opposition leaders were runner-ups. Alassane Ouattara, the leader of the Rally of Republicans and former prime minister, captured 32% of the votes. Ex-president Henri Kone-Bidye, leader of the Democratic Party of Côte d'Ivoire, was in third place with about 25%. Because no candidate received an absolute majority of votes in the first round, a second round was held on November 28th. The aftermath of this election has left the country with two presidents and supporters from each side clashing with each other. After the initial vote on October 31st, ex-president Henri Kone-Bidye threw his support to Alassane Ouattara, which has left us in this particular situation. To speak to us about the current and historical situation in the Ivory Coast, we are first joined by Mawuli Dake. Mr. Dake is the CEO of Africa Group Consult, a premier consultancy firm committed to providing fresh strategic solutions to Africa's challenges. He was a member of the four-member ECOWAS Vision 2020 team, constituted by the president of ECOWAS in the 2008 to develop the current vision of the subregion. Hello, Mr. Dake.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us. I wanted to start by asking you if you could kind of set the context for the November 28th election. I had mentioned what has happened, but what's important for us, I guess, is to understand more of the politics of the country, especially the consternation between the North and South.
Okay. It's great to be on the show, and I think you did a great job by providing the background. But beyond that, what I'd like to add is the institutional and social and cultural factors that make up this complex situation that they find themselves. There is at the bottom of this hole, I think, is the issue of weak institutions. When it comes to elections itself and democracy, institutions in Côte d'Ivoire have not actually been tested because they've been ruled by one man for most of their independence. And after he died, they've had only one election. And even the fact that this is their first election in a decade shows that they have not really tested their institutions. So the institutions are not there to ensure free and fair election. The institutions are not there to hold politicians accountable. The institutions are not there to uphold and defend the outcome of this election. So that is one aspect of it. And then there is the religious and ethnic aspect of it. After their first president died, who was a strong man and held the country together, after his death, they've not been able to have that any other father figure that held everybody together. So cracks developed, and people started to identify more with those they think are us against them. The most controversial of all is the North-South divide, which can also be seen Muslim in the light of Muslim Christian divide. The Northerners are mostly Muslims. Many of them have their descendants coming from Ivory Coast, Mali, and other West African countries. But they have been part of the Ivorian society for some time. But when it came to politics, some people felt that they were not given due recognition, and they were not given the right to participate as those in the South. And the South also said, okay, because you are not full Ivorian. So there was a divide somewhere around the 2000, and it became politicized, and the country was officially, when the UN got involved, to avoid the bloodbath that we saw initially, they set up, it is not a formal division, but kind of a political division to make sure that the rebels who control the North are not able to cause trouble in the South. And then the North has mainly been under rebels' control, militia control, for the past 5 years. So that's a little bit of a context, but it's really complicated, and it will take a while for people to get the full story. But that is briefly some of the conditions that are on the ground right now.
And having this context, thank you for that, is really important for us to start to look at what's happening right now. So I want to then ask you now if we could move particularly to what happened after the November 28th election. As it stands, Laurent Gbagbo and Alassane Ouattara are both saying that they won the election with the Constitutional Court and the Electoral Commission supporting one or the other. So can you talk to us a bit about what happened after November 28th and where it stands now?
Okay. A lot of people ask me about who actually won the election. And what I say is that the two people who were in the election cannot agree who won. So it's difficult for those of us from afar to be so sure about who won and who didn't win. But the bottom line is that from what we have heard and seen, the election, there were a lot of irregularities with the election. So we can't say this was a free and fair election. The Ouattara camp, which is regarded internationally as the winner, considered as the winner of the election, appear to suggest that even though there were irregularities, because they were not that severe, they still won the election. The Gbagbo camp, on the other side, have provided many pieces of evidence to support their claim that the elections were rigged in the North. And mind you, the North, and this is some this is one aspect of the case that I think is important to pay attention to. The elections in the North were conducted under militia and rebel control. So the institutions, I've seen the Africa Union report myself, and I was really surprised that despite this, we have not been able to put the report out for people to see for themselves. It talks about how the rebels did not allow many of the officials to do their job, how the rebels prevented people from voting, how the rebels killed people who they suspected were going to vote for Gbagbo. So Gbagbo's camp, they do have a case about the things that happened in the North. All the same, I think that is why we have institutions. They are supposed to make consider all those circumstances and make a decision based on their judgment as to what can validate an election, what can invalidate an election. And based on that, I think the Electoral Commission, which has the constitutional power to determine these issues, decided to declare Ouattara as the winner. Gbagbo, who also, you know, his people can also argue that they didn't do anything illegitimate, also took the case to court, because the Ivorian system, like many others, they have to, if there's a dispute, there is a court that has the right to resolve the dispute. They have a specific provision in their constitution and in their electoral laws that allow the courts to do that, their constitutional courts to do that. The Constitutional Court considered the evidence that the Gbagbo group provided and declared that the results from the North were not valid. so he canceled those those results. As is normally done, if you cancel the results, what is done is there's a rerun to give the people the chance to revote. But that was not done. He declared Gbagbo the winner. So that is what brought us here. One constitutional entity declared Ouattara the winner, and the other declared Gbagbo the winner. It is hard, from all that we have seen in the international media, there appears to be a universal consensus that Ouattara won. But as to the reality based on the African Union report that I have seen, I don't know, and I can't tell because I wasn't there, but Ouattara is considered the winner by the UN, Africa Union, and ECOWAS.
But as you say, the African Union report and what actually happened is still unclear, but the regional entities and the international community are very quick to put their support behind Ouattara. And I mean, we could take, you know, another show to look at why that is the case, because there are very real political and economic reasons for why they're supporting Ouattara. But what I wanted to ask you was that the regional and international community is supporting Ouattara. And what they're also calling for and what the support is translating into is calls for physical action and military intervention, which is very reactionary. So I wanted to ask you if you could briefly just tell us, what ECOWAS, the African Union, the UN, the US and France, etc., what are they calling for in terms of this military intervention, which seems, of course, to be very reactionary?
I totally agree, and I spoke about this in an article I did last week for Foreign Affairs and Pambazuka. And they have been engaged in a very treacherous warmongering process in Ivory Coast, which I think is extremely dangerous and, frankly, irresponsible. The bottom line is I have worked on elections in Africa and in the U.S., and one thing that you find with almost all elections in recent years is there is always some dispute. And for them to so quickly call for a military violence, military action as a solution, as their response to a political issue, an electoral dispute, I think is extremely irresponsible. But I think that they miscalculated. They were quick to declare support for Ouattara. They were quick to call for military intervention even before they began any form of diplomacy. And it hasn't helped their agenda. It hasn't helped the parties involved. And it is definitely not in the interest of the people in Cote d'Ivoire. So what we have seen is a series of misjudgments and missteps by the international community. I'll give you three quick examples. One, the Africa Union sent Raila Odinga, who is the Prime Minister of Kenya, as their official envoy to go and mediate the situation in Cote d'Ivoire. Raila Odinga was the first African leader to take the side of Ouattara. He was the first African leader to call for military action against Gbagbo. So I really can't think of any tangible justification why African Union would choose such a person. He obviously doesn't have the confidence of the parties involved because he has taken sides and he's called for military action against Gbagbo. So that is one. And then ECOWAS, on the other hand, called a meeting, declared war, basically saying, we are going to overthrow you by military rule. And then they said, okay, we are sending a diplomatic mission. So they also sent an envoy, a team of envoys, to go and mediate. One, that cannot be counted as a credible diplomatic effort because they already declared war against the guy. And secondly, the delegation they sent were President you know, presidents are presidents, but it doesn't mean that all presidents have the same influence. So the three presidents they sent, Kevin, Sierra Leone, the president that they sent, had no political or economic clout that they can use to either convince Gbagbo or compel him to accept their message. So, you know, I don't know what is informing these decisions, and I don't want to question anybody's intentions, but what I have observed is most of the agenda has so far has been defined and driven by France, which obviously has an obsession with Sine Ouattara as president. And so everything is designed around that. So, for instance, if you think of the military action, it clearly shows what their priorities are. They know for a fact that the military option would be a tragic human, will have a tragic human cost for the people of Cote d'Ivoire. So if, for instance, the people of the Ivorians, the citizens, were their priority, I don't think they'll go for such an option. But obviously, they went for the option that can help them use force to get rid of Gbagbo and install the president they prefer. So I think that it is complicated. But I think that there are, even as we try to sort out the complicated issue, I think there are some simple things that we can do, some common sense things that we can do or avoid doing to get this process moving forward and resolve this issue without destroying lives in the country and the same institutions that we will come back to rely on to help us in the future.
And I hope it is obvious to our listeners that a short-term military solution is not a good idea, right? There's the human costs involved first and primary and foremost. Also, in the past, a short-term military solution has not been an effective way to resolve solutions. And the Côte d'Ivoire, I think, as you mentioned in your article, is not, for example, Sierra Leone, right? Côte d'Ivoire has a very strong military response. So I want you to talk, I guess a few things are quite obvious, like the human cost, but talk just briefly about why military intervention is not a good idea.
Okay. Even before I say that, I think that, and this is really intriguing, because if there's one lesson that we've learned in foreign policy in the past decade, it's been that it is not advisable to rush into invasion of another country without counting the cost, without planning, without exit strategy. So it would be very unfortunate if our leaders refuse to fail to learn from this and repeat the same mistake in Africa. But in terms of the dangers of the military action in Cote d'Ivoire particularly, the ECOWAS force, ECOMAC, for instance, was involved in Sierra Leone and Guinea and Liberia. But this is the first time that they will launch an attack against a formidable national army. Most of their interventions have been to help a particular government. In instances that they have intervened, it has been at the invitation of the national government to help them protect citizens against rebels' attack or to help them push back rebels. So it's a totally different situation here. They'll be going in not just against, you know, a small army or rebels, but they are going in against the national army of, and Cote d'Ivoire is not like Sierra Leone or Liberia with a small army. They are a stronger country. They have stronger infrastructure. They have stronger military power. So it is going to be a war between an army that is more resourced than the rebels that they've engaged in the past. And then also, after they get rid of, if they are successful, and I'm sure they are sure they can, that is why they're doing this, if they are successful at violently removing Gbagbo, it will still be the beginning of a long-term process, because the military intervention will not address any of the political issues at stake. So that would just be the beginning of a long process. I don't know what they intend to do with the 50% of Ivorians who have pledged their support for Gbagbo. They are saying they are going to fight with him to the end. So are we going to have a situation where any citizen that is against the invasion, for instance, as we've seen in Iraq, is going to be regarded as a rebel and killed? Are they going to take military action against the other 50%, the almost 50% of the Ivorian citizens that are supporting Gbagbo? I don't know what they intend to do about that. Maybe what you've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it's just a really, really bad idea. And the third point is they don't even have the forces to send to Cote d'Ivoire to go and fight. I'm talking about ECOWAS. Nigeria and Ghana are usually the major suppliers of troops for ECOWAS missions. Ghana, obviously, the president of Ghana has come out to say that he doesn't think that it is in the interest of Ghana or Cote d'Ivoire to start this war. So he has made it clear that he's not going to provide any troops for this action. The other presidents who sat at the ECOWAS meeting and declared war, they themselves, they've not committed any troops. So because they have their own internal issues going on. Nigeria has elections this year, so they are not going to commit their troops to go and fight a war in Cote d'Ivoire that they don't know when it will end. So it was just a miscalculated call they made, and I think it again shows the weakness in leadership in the region and the way they've allowed themselves to be controlled by other interests, particularly France, in this issue.
And in your article that you published last week in Pembezuka News, and I suggest all our listeners check it out, you had listed quite a few recommendations or suggestions for moving forward that do not include military intervention. And I'd like you to speak about those, and especially no one's focusing on what is Alhassan Ouattara's role in this, right? Because the international community is behind him doesn't necessarily mean that he does not have to take steps to move forward. Everyone's putting kind of this pressure on Gbagbo. Not that I'm picking sides, but I think it's fair that Ouattara also takes some responsibility. So I'd like you to speak about that. And then also, what are the role of elders? And you talked about that a bit.
Yeah, okay. Yes. I think it is important. There are two key parties in this conflict. And as we've seen again and again in Africa and other parts of the world, when the international actors, if you are on their side, they either ignore the bad things you do or even support you to do the bad things. So even though, I think your listeners would need to know this. For instance, the United Nations force in Cote d'Ivoire, they are currently in an alliance with the rebels who have taken arms against their country and have been responsible for the violence in the country for the past several years. These same rebels are now in alliance with the UN mission guarding the temporary headquarters of the Ouattara presidency in Côte. So the new rebels and the UN army are guarding the hotel, the Gulf Hotel in Abidjan, where his headquarters is. And it is really interesting that this same group of people that you've been trying to disarm, they've signed several agreements to say they are going to disarm, they're going to hand over their weapons. They've not done that. But now, because they have a short-term interest in using them, now they are supporting them. And these are people who are responsible for various human rights abuses. So it's really worrying. But it is something we've seen and again and again in talking about solutions, I think the first thing is for the international actors to be a bit more responsible with this process. But first of all, I say they should stop the warmongering because they are supposed to help mediate the problem. Their legitimacy comes from our confidence in them to be able to do the right thing and do it in ways that protect the welfare and lives of the people in Cote d'Ivoire. But as of now, they've taken sides and they have become parties the parties with interests in the conflict. So I think that the starting point would be for them to take a step back and strategize properly, redefine their interests and focus, and plan around it. I talked also about using the elders. The elders are a group of former world leaders. It's led by Nelson Mandela. As part of the group, we have Desmond Tutu, we have Mary Robinson, and many other highly prominent, eminent citizens from around the world who are on this committee. And they help to intervene in crises like this. So I think that that is one of the few credible entities that I can think of that can help us in this situation. So I think that ECOWAS should try to get them engaged in this process. Or maybe ECOWAS doesn't need to get them engaged. They can get engaged themselves. That is why they are leaders. That is why they are elders, to provide some guidance and wisdom around these issues. And I think WANEP is the West African Network for Peace Building, one of the most well-known, one of the most credible peace-building institutions in Africa. And they have long called for an international mediation team to help resolve this issue. And I think it's high time we have an international mediation team that is has the confidence of both sides in the situation and can help us navigate the process. Because no matter what we do, even if we take up arms, even if we use military, whatever, at the end of the day, we will still need to resolve the issues, the political issues. So I think that that is a good place to start. But in the long term, as I started by saying, I think that politicians everywhere would steal elections if they have the chance. The difference is between those who have institutions in their country and empowered citizens in their country that would not allow them to steal the elections, and those who don't have those institutions and empowered citizens that allow them to steal elections. So the long-term solution, of course, would be to support and build electoral institutions, empowered citizens that can actively participate in this process, uphold and defend the outcome of these elections. So those are just some few ideas. There's been a lot of discussion going on at various levels, and we've been providing some strategic ideas. But those are some key, a few key steps that we can start taking.
Mr. Dake, I would really like to thank you for joining us today and sharing your insights. It definitely has opened up our analysis of the current situation, especially for only tuning into these really poor mainstream medias that are kind of advocating this international intervention solution. So we've unfortunately reached the end of our time, but I'd really like to thank you. And if you'd like to say a few closing words, go ahead.
Well, I thank you also for the opportunity, and I think that we should continue to create our own platforms so that we don't have to rely on the one-sided mainstream media that promote particular interests instead of what we need to know. And finally, all I want to say is that I think that as Africans, we are all sick and tired of politicians who steal our vote, deny our rights. So in the long term, I think it is ultimately our responsibility as citizens to build our own capacity with the information and tools and power that we need to be able to defend our rights, defend our votes, and promote our democracy. So I wish the people of Cote d'Ivoire all the best, and I am optimistic that they will come out victorious and not the parties that have pushed them into this bad situation. So I thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye. And you are tuned into African Perspectives on CHRY 105.5 FM. I'm your host this week, Omeysa Marahemtula, and we are talking about the Ivory Coast and the current impasse from the recent elections. We're going to take a quick community listening break and be back with Mr. Gary Bush, who will speak to us about more of this analysis. Stay tuned.
Your community radio,
CHRY
105.5.
And we are back on CHRY 105.5 FM. You are tuned into Africans' Perspectives, and we now continue our analysis of the current electoral crisis in Cote d'Ivoire. We are joined by Dr. Gary Bush, an international trade unionist, academic, businessman, and political affairs and business consultant. Hello, Gary. How are you?
Hello. How are you?
Good, thank you. So I wanted to start off by asking you to kind of set the historical context of the current electoral impasse in Cote d'Ivoire, and especially around the North-South division and the peace process. So I wanted to start off by maybe asking you about the role of France in this current situation. France, of course, being the ex-colonial, ex in quotations, yeah, colonial power in Cote d'Ivoire, who have never really left. So if you could just maybe give us a bit of that context.
Yes, indeed. France theoretically gave some of their Francophone African states the independence in 1960. This is called flag independence, which meant that the country would have a flag, a national anthem, and a seat on the United Nations, and all the rest of it stayed under French rule. The French made them sign what was known as the Colonial Pact. The Colonial Pact, which they had to sign before they became independent, said that the France would have the rights to control their economies, that they would have to allow for armies, French armies, to stay in their countries, that they would have a monopoly, French companies would have a monopoly on gas, oil, electric power, water in the countries, that they had a certain quota of money, goods they had to buy from France, and that all the strategic resources would have to be offered to France first. This was agreed to by the various African countries. In addition to which, the national currency, the CFA franc, was controlled and is controlled entirely by the French treasury. So when an African country does trade, 60% of the money it earns is deposited immediately into one of the West African banks, which is held by the French treasury. An additional 20% is sent over as security. So 80% of everybody's income is held in France by 9 officials in the French treasury who invested in the French bourse. Most African countries have no idea how much money they have because they move it around themselves. So this is a way in which the countries seem to have independence, but their financial independence is such that it's very, very difficult to them to take any initiatives on their own. Additionally, when we take it down to the case in the Ivory Coast, when Mr. Bagbo was elected in 2000, he said, "This is a crazy business. Why should we have everything reserved for France? We would like to have Canadian companies, American companies, British companies come in and tender for the various dams and the various projects that we're doing." And the French said, "You can't do that. The Colonial Pact says you have to give this to the French companies." So Bagbo said, "No, this is not right. We're going to open it up to international tender so we can get the advantages of cost and integration." At which time, the French supported a group of rebels who were attacking the government. They went into Abidjan, they killed a couple of the officers, they killed the ex-president guy. Then the Ivory Coast army drove them back north to Bouaké. And they had them surrounded in Bouaké, and were about to attack them, when the French demanded a 48-hour ceasefire so they could take their citizens out. But in that 48 hours, they dropped in French paratroopers who lined up with the rebels to protect them. Which then they brought in massive quantities of arms from most of it came from Franceville and Gabon, the rest came from Ukraine, and they brought in Liberian, Sierra Leonean mercenaries to fight on the side of the rebels, which effectively split the country. So from the early 2002, the country was split in half, and the French troops lined up to separate the north from the south so they couldn't attack them anymore. The economy in the north became the preserve of the little tin pot warlords. And the founder of all this was a guy called Ouattara, who was being directed by Blaise Compaoré of Burkina Faso. They took over the country. They paid no taxes to the south. They didn't pay for their water. They didn't pay for their gas. They didn't pay for their electricity. The whole north of the country subsists on the right of the expenses of the South. The educational system, all the civil servants left. The educational system left. There was no hospitals, no schools, no roads, no anything. And so from 2002 to today, there's practically nothing in the North. It's been run by these warlords who collect their fees but pay no taxes, and they're not really part of the government. And the father of the revolution, Ouattara, decided that he wanted to be the president, and the French decided that it was a good idea. There was occasional problems in 2004 when the Ivory Coast government decided they were going to try to stop some of the rebel incursions in the north, at which time the French government sent in more troops. They seized the airport, they destroyed the Ivory Coast Air Force, and they marched on the president's, with 100 tanks, they marched on the president's residence. They stopped in the Hotel Ivoire. A whole bunch of students and activists tried to stop them from attacking the president. The French opened fire with the tanks and with their weapons and snipers from the roof, and they killed 68 of the Ivorians and wounded 1,300 others, but they were able to preserve Gbagbo. There have been innumerable peace talks with Minas, Marcoussi, Accra, Pretoria, all of which said that the first thing they had to agree with was for the rebels to disarm. The rebels agreed, but they never disarmed. As a result of this, the international community decided that it wasn't right for Gbagbo to rule on his own, so they instilled cabinet ministers from all the rebel parties and all the opposition parties. So Gbagbo, up until now, has not had a government of his own to run. The ministries have been filled, at least half of them, with the rebel ministers. Soro was put in as prime minister after Ouagadougou talks. So it has been powerless. So Western countries, particularly France, have been saying you must have elections. So they have the elections prepared, but before you're supposed to have the elections, you have to have disarmament. You can't have half the country under these rebel bands, not even an army, there's rebel bands, controlling the forces. And they, every time they said they were going to do it, they didn't. So they had this election, and the first round went reasonably well. The second round, the results, which there was an electoral commission. The electoral commission was subservient to the Constitutional Council. They took the oath of loyalty February 25th of last year. The rebel count, this electoral council collected the votes on their own without verifying them, without consolidating them, and they went to Ouattara's hotel and made the announcement that Ouattara won. And they said, this is crazy. This is supposed to go to the Constitutional Council to be voted on, to look at, to be inspected. And they, Ouattara's campaign officers, who was also on the Electoral Commission, who did this. On the Electoral Commission, there was 20 political appointees, 18 from Ouattara's side and 2 from Gbagbo. It's not surprising that why they won. So this disturbance, the whole thing is mainly to do with French colonial interests. Now, the French realized after the uproar about what happened in 2004 that they couldn't use their own forces to go in and fight the Ivory Coast. It was too much of an embarrassment for them. In fact, all the European Union said, well, we're very happy to have people fighting, but we don't want white soldiers killing Africans. So the only way we can do it is if we can convince the Africans to kill other Africans. And what they can be killing is not soldiers to begin with, they're killing civilians. They want African soldiers from the African countries to go in and kill Ivory Coast civilians. And this is not on. The presidents in ECOWAS who voted them for this, most of whom came into power by military coups, assassinating their predecessors, rigged elections, or extending the term limits of their own constitutions, and have a very small claim on democracy at the best of times, decided they were going to agree that they were going to send in forces. They don't have the forces, and if they did, there was such an uproar in their own countries that they run the risk of being thrown out of office themselves. So that basically is the background.
There's also a question that you mention a bit in your article. This question, and it's always been a persistent question, and I think it very much comes out of this colonial situation and this migration for work, but this idea of Ivoirian identity or Ivoirite. So can you talk a bit about how this election is very, and even the conflict in the North and South, is very imbued within this discourse or these ideas of, you know, like a pure Ivoirian identity?
Well, the whole during the colonial rule, the French had French Equatorial Africa and French East West Africa. And in these, there was free movements of people. So the Ivory Coast was a very prosperous area, and a lot of it was done with cocoa farms and the rest. And so there was a great migration from Burkina Faso and Mali and other places. They were generally called the Mossi. They came down to work in the Ivory Coast, many of whom kept going back and forth to the home, but many of them settled. There was always a fight over whether they had the rights, the same rights as the other Ivorians, because they were distinct. But if you go to places in Abidjan and the ports, there's full of merchants from all over the place. There wasn't that hostility. Bedi, who was the head of, who took over after Houphouet Boigny died, became the head of the PDCI, became the president of the Ivory Coast. His first act was to say there must be Ivoirite, and there was a constitutional agreement made that before you could stand for political office, both parents had to be certified as being born in the Ivory Coast. At which time, he took 12,000 Ivory Coast residents who happened to have a Burkinabe origin and sent them home. This is not Gbagbo. This was the Bedi of the PDCI, who recently made the alliance with Ouattara. He was Ouattara's main enemy, which is a bit ironical in this case. And so there has been this problem where the people in the North feel that they have not had the same rights as the people in the South. And to some degree, they're right. There has been prejudice against the Muslim North. There has been prejudice because many of them were transient workers, or they took land which traditionally belonged to the families who had already settled in the North. Now, this Muslim issue is one of the key issues in the whole solution of the Ivory Coast. But the United Nations, in its wisdom, has made it even more difficult because the peacekeepers they sent to the Ivory Coast to replace some of the French soldiers and to keep the peace between the North and the South are from Pakistan, Bangladesh, Morocco, and Jordan. Almost all the peacekeepers the United Nations sent are Muslims. This is why they get on so well with the rebels. And the people in the South of the Ivory Coast, this is crazy. How can we have neutrality? How can we trust the United Nations to be fair when they're sending in Muslim peacekeepers to look after the Muslims of the North, and this is one of the bones of contention between the two of us?
There's also, I guess, more of a situation now? I mean, this is coming to light now. It's always been a situation. These have always been contentions since, you know, what you call flag independence. But it's come to a kind of, hopefully, a kind of impasse at this point that maybe can allow for some movement forward. So what are would be your recommendations? How does Côte d'Ivoire move forward from here on in?
Well, it's a question, this impasse is a question really from where you sit. At the moment, the South is fairly well united under Gbagbo, loyal to him. The North is in the, still with the rebels, and Ouattara is sitting isolated in a hotel room in the middle of a Gulf hotel, making his presence known under a tent, and he says that Gbagbo has a problem. The United Nations is not going to invade. Europeans aren't going to invade. The ECOWAS isn't going to invade. So it's a question of when Ouattara decides he wants to go home. They've been provoking attacks on the police and the soldiers in the hopes that they'll create an incident that the world community will feel that they could be forced to come in and intervene. But Gbagbo is in a fairly good position. He doesn't have to listen to the so-called international community. There are plenty of people, China, Russia, all kinds of people want to buy their cocoa and take their oil. They don't need to send the stuff to the United States or Western Europe. There's plenty of cocoa. It's the largest cocoa producer in the world. People want to buy cocoa. And this is one of the reasons why Ghana doesn't want to have to fight with them, because they're also the second largest producer. It's an impasse, but it's an impasse as long as the Western powers and the United Nations decide that they want to support an immoral and irrational position. Now, I get really annoyed when I see the Western press and these others saying there has to be an invasion. I have had experience. I've been in 5 African wars, and I can assure you there's absolutely nothing more horrific and frightening and nasty and vicious than an African war. And to see people with their arms and legs chopped off, people being wounded, left to die in the roads, it's not something that anybody should even think of, let alone want to do. This is aberration. This is not something that the United Nations just suddenly say, well, we're going to go in and we're going to promote this type of... This is a horrific, horrific war. And the children, they lost a generation of education in the North. The people in the South are afraid of having all of a sudden violence disturbing them. If you went in Christmas in the Ivory Coast, with all the damages and danger was going on, the people were quite calm. They were shopping, having going to parties, they're having a reasonable time. It's only in the areas around the Gulf Hotel where they have some kind of problems, or down in Abobo where you have large concentrations of the northern people. So the situation is really going to work itself out. Now, if the Gbagbo and the southerners decide that there's a real danger, then they have very number of things that they can do which doesn't involve war. For example, all the electricity for the North comes from the South. They can turn off the switch. All the water for the North comes from the South. They can turn off the valve. All the fuel that they use comes from the refineries in the South. They can stop that happening. There are any number of things that Gbagbo can do, which he hasn't done yet, in the hopes that someone is going to have some sense and sit down and negotiate. Now, I can't tell you myself, or nobody can tell you, who actually won the election in terms of the vote, because they've never been verified. So what they've been saying is, isn't this time that you have a reputable international committee come, look at the ballots, find out on what basis the Constitutional Council made its recommendation, and then decide who actually won this? You can't preempt a vote. It's like if the United Nations decided they were going to send Russian and Cuban troops into Miami to protect Al Gore against the Supreme Court. It's nonsense.
Gary, we have reached the end of our time, but I would really like to thank you today for joining us, for your analysis, and your participation, and kind of looking forward. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And you are tuned in to CHRY 105.5 FM. This is African Perspectives, and we are at the end of our show today. Remember, you can reach African Perspectives by email. Our email address is africanperspectives@chry.fm, or you can check out our blog and listen to past shows. And our blog is afri-perspectives.blogspot.com. And the music you heard today on African Perspectives, our opening theme is always Mwana F.A. featuring A.Y. Habari Ndio Hio. We also heard from Kanda Bongo Man, the song Sai. We heard from Salif Keita's Tomorrow. And we will end now with Samira Said, Yum Wara Yum, CHRY 105.5 FM, African Perspectives.
لا كده كفاية حبيبي مهما كنت بغي بقلبك كنت ويايا أنا راجعة يا أغلى حبيبي بقولك لا كده كفاية حبيبي مهما كنت بغي بقلبك كنت وياه